Hello and welcome. My name is Russell Trapper-Jones and this is Broadcast Focus, the show where we talk to the people behind the broadcast media and entertainment industry. We're looking at a range of radio-themed topics now on the run-up to Radio Tech Con at the end of November. Earlier, I was joined by Valentin, who talked to us about Dutch community radio. But today, I'm very pleased to be joined by Phil Hagger, a roving consultant who has a lot of experience in radio. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Russell. Thanks for the chance to come on and chat and reminisce about lovely projects in radio around the world.
So you describe yourself as a roving consultant. That tends to mean you go to a lot of places. What kind of things do you get up to?
I'm never happier than when I can go back to Africa. I used to live in Zambia back in the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. And after doing a degree in engineering, applied physics and electronics, and working in TV for about 6 years, I had the chance to go to Zambia when they were launching their first independent radio stations, because it was previously a single party political system.
So was it just one radio, like state radio channel?
Yeah, there were two or three. I think there were like Radio 1, 2, and 4, and I'm not sure what happened to 3. Right. But going out there and living there gave me a taste for travel. And a taste for Africa, which I had visited previously as a student, and I went to Kenya. But going and living there was really, really different. And I was there for a purpose, to start up a radio station. And then after that, I came back and worked in the UK as an engineer, things like the televising of Parliament in Westminster. Mm. And then various other parliaments, it became a little bit of a niche, went to Northern Ireland, went to Brussels. To have a look at theirs, and then got into streaming in the very, very early days of streaming, even before YouTube. And we were streaming pop concerts like Glastonbury and Reading, and we were streaming Tony Blair from Number 10, and having a bit of a whale of a time, because it was new, and it was back in the day when money was sloshing around, and it was all good fun. And from streaming, I then ended up working for an independent TV production company called 2-4. We made a lot of TV programs and we had a strong digital division. Mm-hmm. And after that, which was about 11 years ago, I stopped going on other people's payrolls and decided that what I loved doing was traveling and, of course, working in broadcasting. And it's a real blessing that broadcasting has such a wide remit of different things you can do, from the creative and operations, the technology, and even the business side of it. So over the last 11 plus years, I've traveled all around Africa, down into the South Atlantic, to the Falklands, across to Asia and in the Middle East, working in challenging environments, typically. Even nearly got sucked into Afghanistan just as things got a little dicey there a couple of years ago. And I was told, come to the green zone, Phil, it's safe. And my wife said, don't go to the green zone, Phil. In hindsight. And I often say this in hindsight, she was right. So roving around doing gnarly broadcast projects, I guess, is what you'd find on my CV.
Nice. It sounds interesting and sounds like we've got plenty we can talk about. I think what I wanted to talk about today was setting up the station or stations in Zambia. I think it's interesting, not only because I think just generally understanding how people have set up radio station is kind of interesting for the right type of person, but as you say, it was like at a particularly important time when things were changing in the country, from being public owned or state only to, was this a commercial radio station that you were initially setting up?
It was actually a charity. It was funded by a very wealthy Christian businessman from the UK. And at the invitation of the new president of Zambia, he wanted media plurality. And we were invited out to train up about 30 local people in a different way of doing radio, because under the previous regime. And let's, you know, let's not forget that prior to Zambia becoming independent, it was Rhodesia or North Rhodesia. It was a colony. And a lot of the colonial approach to running things was still very evident back in the mid-90s. So it would have probably been about 30 years, 25 years after independence. So the broadcaster, its role was the voice of government, effectively telling the people what to do or what to think. So if you tuned into the news was the president has done this, he has opened this thing, he has shaken hands with this person. And in other news, the vice president has opened this thing and shaken hands with that lady. And as you might imagine, the weather was, for us, it's 40 degrees in the shade. And yeah, we might have a thunderstorm in a couple of months. I mean, that's, it's not, a, you know, I'm kind of like being a bit stereotyped. I love the place and I love working in Zambia and I love the people and go back to Zambia in Africa when I can. But when we got there, that's all they knew. The broadcast presenters were called announcers. They weren't really exhibiting an awful lot of personality. And in those days, you know, we'd come through people like Kenny Everett on the radio, who had more personality than men. So the opportunity to sort of like cross-fertilize the experience that I'd had of BBC radio and, dare I say, even hospital radio and all the different independent radio that we had, the early Zoo formats and things like that, these were not something that Zambia was familiar with. Even, you know, like laughing and being a friend to the listener is a very different relationship than an authority announcing to the audience.
Yeah, I think Kenny Everett had enough personality for several DJs and presenters to share around. But I think that's the interesting aspect. I mean, I agree, individually, everybody's lovely, but when people are conditioned to work in a certain way, then the output becomes very, I don't know, staid and perhaps it loses a lot of possibility of what radio could be. So
it's very challenging, sorry to interrupt, but challenging in recruiting staff, because those who were known as being radio professionals came from that announcing way of doing things. So we took a couple of those on, lovely, lovely people. And we also took on 10 or 15 bubbly characters who were fun to listen to and put them in front of the mics. And my role as the manager, I literally had nobody telling me what to do, was to try and create a 24/7 radio station with talent who had never been behind a mic other than one of the older guys who, you know, who was an old announcer.
So how did this start off then? So you've got the this philanthropist, this Christian in the UK, and he's found you and said you need to be like the station manager. Or was there someone else that you were meeting? And
you're kind of summarizing a slightly torturous journey. I'm not the easiest person to manage. So, and I was also quite young in those days, with more hair and very, you know, I knew what I wanted to do and how to do it. Yet for some reason, my path crossed with this chap. And he and his team said, OK, we'll send you to Zambia with your wife and about 2-year-old toddler daughter as the acting station manager, because we're not quite sure about you. There's something about you that we're troubled about, but yet you seem to know how to do it. So we went out to Zambia in 1994. And Sam, my wife, my daughter Maddie and I, we had no preconceptions, no training. We landed there. We got put in a pickup truck and we bumped down a dirt road for an hour because the radio station was based on a farm outside of Lusaka. And this was remote and there were snakes and bugs. And literally we, you know, I remember the first night when we unpacked, we had photos of our family and we were so dislocated and upset. We just left them. We didn't want to look at them. We didn't want to be reminded of what life was. We were in a metal prefabricated hut on a recently cleared bit of bush, with the noise of the African bush, the cicadas, and we had monkeys outside. I mean, this was alien, Russell. There was no cultural training or introduction, and it was really challenging for us. Go ahead.
Is this the house that you sent me a photo of?
Subsequent house? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was our house, and the on the left,
see the metal roof.
You imagine what that's like in 40 degrees. There's no aircon. The little bit of shade cloth in green was the extension we put on to stop the vehicle that occasionally I was allowed to borrow from roasting. And right on the corner with the two windows open, that was our bedroom. And with the one window open, that's where our daughters sat slept in a cot under a mosquito net. And the monkeys would come around. And this photo is probably 2.5 years in, because there's grass and bushes and whatever. Yeah, but it was literally in the bush and a long way away from Hatfield in Harts, where we'd previously been living.
Yeah, a while ago, in the early 90s, I went on with my family to Zambia for a month, and we went around with a missionary who had been there for many years. So, of course, she was welcomed back with open arms in all the places we went to. So it was quite handy. But I do recall, I very much recall being in the back of pickup trucks, finding out how deep potholes can be. I think that we were given some foam for the back end. And I also remember, sleeping in places where, I think worse for me is how cold it gets at night often.
Certainly, the weather was a challenge for us, not least because when it was hot, it was hot. When it was cold, it wasn't. But when it rained, we were an hour out of town down a dirt road. And every morning we relied on a rather old bus to bring 20 to 30 staff from Lusaka, where they'd wait outside the post office. And it didn't always arrive, because sometimes it got stuck in the mud, literally. And
so they were commuting
that's a challenge, because who's going to do the breakfast show when your presenter's still halfway up the road stuck in a hole?
And is the answer you?
Yeah, the answer is me. you know, for those of us that have done student radio or hospital radio, and literally Alan Partridge is too real and too scary because it reminds us of all the ways that we've been on air, sliding into a radio studio in a swivel chair with no one else around, with the African sun coming up, it was sometimes an out-of-body experience. And one of the things that really made it different from when I used to, I must say, play at hospital radio in Hartford with friends, was that we had a 100 kilowatt shortwave transmitter that meant that what I said would hit about 10 African countries, from Rwanda up north. And Rwanda was having a bad time at the time, down to South Africa. And we had probably the biggest, strongest signal on the shortwave dial at that time, which led to some very strange things happening that could have been damaging to my ego. For example, to get to Victoria Falls from where we lived was about an 8-hour drive, bumping along in a pickup, stopping and buying some bananas some drinks from people on the road. And then you get to Vic Falls, you find a nice hotel, not that we were rich or anything, but you could often blag in and say, look, we're locals, and they'd give you a locals rate. And then go down to the falls or a safari area. And I remember there was a guy standing at a security booth, checking the people as they went into the national park with one of those arms that lifts up across the road. And he was actually listening to our radio station on his shortwave radio, because it was the only thing that he could hear. And if you just, I was just thinking, just imagine, in the vast shortwave footprint we had, how many people just happened to tune in to the loudest station on the dial? And going back to your question, on occasion, that was Phil sitting in a old swivel chair with a Clyde desk and a pushing the fader up, talking to the studio. But, you know, what an impact. And that is literally, you know, broadcasting is that. It's sending a story or a message or information out to a broad amount of people in a large coverage area. I mean, it's just like, it's unreal even thinking back now about who might have tuned in.
Turning up and hearing your own voice on the radio is kind of interesting as well.
It's, yeah, it really, I did hear that once because I recorded a program on, I think it was DAT. We were very pleased to have some tiny digital audio recording for it. This was really before hard disk recording. And yeah, literally down at Lake Kariba and hearing my own voice coming out of someone's radio. I mean, radio presenters are used to it, aren't they? But in the middle of Africa, it seemed a bit different.
So this is the... Is this the dirt track that you were hoping your staff came down?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And it was an interesting, another skill to add to the CV, the ability to drive on corrugations and to know how to steer around big potholes and things, which become second nature when you do it once or twice a day. But it did mean that as my daughter, Maddie, became of school age, she would have had a 1 hour journey up that road come rain or strong sunshine, and that was one of the reasons why. Well, one of the reasons why we came back to the UK. But the other reason was that, having worked with my colleagues for coming on to 3 years, there was no need for me to be there. I didn't want them to look at me and say,
"Yeah,
like Dumbo and Dumbo's feather, we need Phil to be there as the manager." I wanted them to be trained up and to take it. And 30 years later, it's still running. So. Yeah, this is coming into the radio station. We started off fairly low security. There was an attempted coup in Zambia, and we heard, because we had two-way radios, kind of like a farm network, where neighbouring farms can talk to each other in the event of problems. And we heard on the farm network, there are soldiers from the people trying to take over Zambia coming down to take over the radio station because you have the most powerful signal to reach the whole country. Luckily, they never got there.
That's pretty concerning.
Because you saw that road, and that road was on a good day. But if you have some very dodgy vehicles and you don't perhaps have enough diesel, after about 45 minutes, it becomes quite a challenge to get there. So they didn't get there. But after the coup was stopped, the government said, "Do you know what? We recognise that there is a risk, and we'll post some paramilitary police at your station." So then it all became a bit more serious.
I see. Gosh, well, I'm glad they didn't make it. That's
I'm feeling nervous just
hearing the story.
We did have sort of like get things in a grab bag and ready to go because literally we didn't know how serious it was. So in the early days, then when I arrived, the ground for the station had been cleared and the buildings were just going up, and the mast that you see there was our link, our telephone link. So it's nothing to do with radio. It's just like there were no phone lines. So forget any ideas of call-ins, forget any idea really of just calling your family and saying we're here safe. When we first got there, it's half an hour to get to the nearest telephone. And then, you know, operator, I'd like to speak to Hertfordshire to talk to family. So the buildings that we had there, we needed, first of all, practically, we needed to have a kitchen, because once the staff were there for the day, they were there for the day. So we'd have the traditional mealy meal, which is like maize meal porridge. And we had some local cooks. And by being on a farm, we had loads of access to fruit and vegetables and maybe the odd chicken. So other than the kitchen and little like washrooms and things, we had an office building. And then we had a building, which I think is the one that you can see on the right, which had three studios. So we had two on-air studios, which we could cycle between with, if I use the expression offer and accept. Do you know what I mean? So I'm in the studio. I'm finishing my show. Mm-hmm. I offer you in the other studio to take control. You've got your studio all set up how you want. So we ping-ponged between the two studios. Okay. Then we had a third identical studio, which was used for recording when visitors came in, or we wanted to record some programs that played out at other times of day. And, so, and quite often we'd record an interview program or a music and interview program. Like, for example, if you're a small business person, like a hairdresser or an accountant, and you just want to learn a little bit about business and marketing, and we might say, look, these programs could run again. They could run a couple of times during the day, at the weekend, but in a year's time, we might dig them out of the archive again. So we had a recording, it's like one person with two guests type thing. And our news presenter would come in and sit in the guest seat. There's no news studio. And we also had a round table room where both of the on-air studios could act as control rooms for that discussion studio.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Then after a while, we opened a multi-track recording studio. And this was fantastic for us. And I also hope it was good for musicians in Zambia, because we wanted local national music on air. Actually, just behind the mango tree, I think, is the multi-track studio. And this is a couple of years later, once things had really grown beautifully. And so we said, come in and record your albums free of charge, because we've got the kit.
Yeah.
We want your music on air. We want to sound authentically Zambian. And you can take your master mixed copy back to you, which they then went and duplicated onto first cassette and then to CD. So we gave them, if you like, we seeded that sort of recorded music market. And again, it was in the days before you can do multi-track on a laptop. This was proper multi-track on tapes. And we had a great engineer to facilitate that. So it was a lovely pioneering time. We met loads of great, you know, musicians and artists that came down. And one guy tried to teach me to play African Rumba guitar, not without much success. But this was all part of, and what the broadcast industry and what my job gave me is like a really rich tapestry of experiences and acquaintances and really close friends as well. So anyway, we started broadcasting across 10, 11, 12 countries, and we would get letters from all over Southern Africa coming in. And we realized, unfortunately, that the skip zone of shortwave meant that we missed the capital, which was 30 or 40 kilometers away, because shortwave goes and when it bounces and lands, that's okay. But if you're really close to the transmitter, you don't get a particularly good signal. Well, that was easy. Go and knock on the door of the Ministry of Information and say, could we have an FM license? Sure, yeah, no problem at all. So we put an FM transmitter and antenna on the top of a big hotel in the middle of Lusaka and didn't look back. It was absolutely brilliant fun.
How did people respond to, you know, this new style of radio?
In a very positive way. And in a way that was challenging for the presenters, who became celebrities out of nowhere. But we were really, really well received. The government liked it. And the audience seemed to like it. Yeah, the government liking it was important. And we did things that were well received by the music industry. For example, I helped form the music copyright collection society. I didn't help form it, but as kind of like one of the prime stations that was playing local music, we wanted to ensure the music creators made money from it. So the Zambia Copyright Protection Society, we were, if not the first, we were formative in ensuring that we paid our due to the musicians. And we also helped the ministry understand how it should react when people said, we want to launch a radio station. After starting that one, I started another one with a colleague in Zambia. And the application for a license that we put in was then used as a template for the regulator to ask any other applicants, please fill in, you know, this sort of sections of the report that Phil and Mike did for Breeze FM, which was on the the border in a place called Chipata on the border between Zambia and Malawi. So, I think we did do a fair bit of positive contribution. And again, let me just reiterate, the really important thing was to do like a skills transfer and to make sure that I did myself out of a job, really.
Yeah. Here's someone that you helped get into the job.
Very close friend. This is Francis. So you can see a Clyde console. There's probably in the background a DAT or or CD player. Yeah, a CD player up
here's a CD on player the right. There.
And alongside the PPMs, you can see printed out a clock that says this is what we expect you to do during this hour of program. And next to that, not so easy to see, were some little drawings I did in a very early version of PowerPoint saying, don't make sure your PPMs don't go too high up. This is a nice position between about 4 and 5.5 and things like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, little old Clyde desk.
That's nice.
And Kachinga, that's a reverse angle of the same one. You can see the audio carts behind his head.
Yeah.
The good old days. And through the, which you can't see, but through the blinds just to his right, the window would then look out onto the shortwave transmitter and then out across the farm that we were based on in Africa.
So we've got a picture of the transmitter inside.
Continental 4180, that every time we turned it on, and we didn't turn it off very often, but every time we turned it on, the lights dimmed in the surrounding buildings. And we had a massive great generator because we were quite reliant on an electricity company that to this day still has challenges. There's a lot of demand for electricity, and a lot of Zambia's electricity came from hydropower. And with the recent climate changes, hydropower is becoming quite an issue. Okay. So there's a term, and maybe you've heard of it, called load shedding, which effectively means the electrical company says, going to turn off this region between these hours or on these days. And for us, to stay on air, we had to run a generator, and it was a big one to power 100 kilowatts. And it's the sort of transmitter that you can actually open doors and get inside to look at things like high power amplifiers or whatever.
How did the the fuel deliveries work out for you? Do you have a massive tank?
Yeah, we did. And because Zambia was pretty agricultural, and things like boreholes to get your water to irrigate your fields come out of the ground, those boreholes would typically run on diesel. So that wasn't so much of an issue. I mean, if a diesel lorry was a bit late, don't worry, you had a few big tanks around. We were grateful to be funded by a UK businessman who didn't really worry too much if we had to go on the Jenny for a weekend.
Right. Well, that's good. You don't want to get in trouble for keeping the station on air, do you, really?
On the contrary, I mean, the problems were that happened is when we went off air, there was nobody to come and tell us how to fix the transmitter. I mean, they would have been 4 days away to get, you know, if we put out a call to get someone to come in. So it did mean that, we were down looking at the circuit diagrams and trying to work out how this enormous great transmitter hall, you know, within it, all the different things that we had to do. And so we, in a way, it was kind of, well, it was remote. And that, you know, we just felt we had to stay on air. And so you would improvise. And Africans are past masters at improvising to do things.
Did it often fail? Transmitters tend to keep going, don't they?
Yeah, it seemed to. I mean, if you've got a dodgy power supply, dodgy mains, and you didn't have an automatic voltage regulator, and suddenly your mains shot way out of spec, it didn't like it. So we got a big AVR the size of a small car that stabilized it. But it's not really the sort of thing you have a UPS for when you've got 100 kilowatts of outgoing power and taking more of that off the grid. It tended to be power. And also if you've got lightning and you've got your antennas, and you know, if your grounding's not right, there are these kind of like risks when you're playing with big bits of electricity.
Indeed.
I go back when I can, and this is what a typical radio station in Lusaka might look like now. A lovely little radio station. This is called Kapi Talk, which is a talk radio station. It's got one studio. It's got the STL on top of that little antenna studio to transmit a link. You can do things very, as I said before about being innovative, Africans are brilliantly innovative. They can, or we can, all working together, create radio stations with a very low amount of capital expenditure. So just a couple of rooms, some makeshift soundproofing, and they're broadcasting, you know, across the capital in a way that in the UK and maybe Europe, unless you were doing student radio, you'd consider a bit seat of your pants. But yeah, you can do it in a single story bungalow just off, you know, in a residential area. And I just wanted to show you, you know, the why I love Africa, the blue skies, the beautiful green trees, the vegetation, the people. Yes. I mean, who wouldn't want to work in an environment like that?
For anyone based in the UK, a casual reference to a mango tree, as you did earlier, is notable. But yeah, no, it's a lovely place. And certainly when I was there, I was struck by the friendliness of everybody. And it was a really nice environment to go around in, and I enjoyed it a lot.
But also, do expect the unexpected, because if they knew your broadcast experience, they could have done something funny like they did to me a couple of years ago. Well, when I went to see Kapi Talk, I was just going to have a look because it was set up by a former top news journalist from ZNBC, Frank Mutabila. And Frank was like a kind of a Dimbleby figure from the UK. You know, he was the sort of like senior current affairs news guy. He used to have his own chat show about current affairs. Then he became an ambassador, if I remember rightly. Then he came back to Open Kapi Talk. So I went to see how he was getting on. Within 5 minutes, I thought it was going to be a cup of tea or whatever. Put these headphones on. We're going live on air with you, Phil. And Frank sits down and he opens up the phaser and he starts saying, tell me about how you perceive the economic situation in Zambia now after you've been away for 20 years. And it went on like that for about 15 to 20 minutes. And he was grilling me about all sorts of deep things. And I was just counting my lucky stars because for whatever reason, I decided to do an MSc in business during COVID with a focus on sub-Saharan Africa. So I was just able to answer some of these questions about economics and the population, demographic dividend, and all these other things that never in my life should I have been on a chat radio talking about African economics, really. But that's typical. I mean, it is typical. That's lovely about working in environments like that. You literally, you know, if you come from Europe, if you have some experience, if you're open to share it, they are the people that I know there, and when you visit, they love to understand what, you know, how can we do better, what can I learn from them. It's just a really interactive, as you say, friendly environment.
Yeah. Perhaps one thing I'd like to think about and ponder on is the viability and how useful radio is and its continued place. I sometimes hear a little bit of two versions of the same story, that, you know, when you're in the heart of the bush, there's not a lot of internet around, so you're not going to be streaming. But on the other hand, I hear stories where the only thing an African country does is use mobile phones, and the cell infrastructure is there. And, you know, it was probably more true 10 years ago than it is now, but effectively there were more on mobile phones data than Western countries in Europe. Yeah. So there's a little bit of two things going on, because actually I do think that just like everywhere in the world, we're going more towards the internet for listening to stuff. And it doesn't mean that it's not audio only, it's just radio in a different way. But in terms of broadcast radio, there is still this importance of, obviously, for every country has the importance for when it is vital that the government distributes information rather than simply, you know, who's been glad-handing who on this day or the other. And it's also an efficient way, as you've been describing, to have one transmitter and hit half of Africa. It's not too bad, is it? We're continuing to play off these things. And I think that radio, as in a broadcast medium, still has some viability. Or is it clear to you that there's still these conversations that we've been having over in Europe about which one should we switch off? When will FM go this way and the other way, like Norway's done? Is there anything close to that conversation happening in Africa?
Well, let's be, put our hands up and say, when we say in Africa, that is with respect, a dreadful thing to try and lump more than 50 countries into a single entity. Mm-hmm. And if you go to Morocco in North Africa or Cape Town in South Africa or Lusaka in Zambia, yeah, they're on the same continent, but they're as different as they are alike. They're the middle of, if you imagine, for example, the fiber optic cables that come down the Indian Ocean, so the east side of Africa, and they land at places like Mombasa in Kenya, and in Mozambique and Dar es Salaam and places in Tanzania, they are the umbilicals of IP that mean that if you're near the coast and you've got access to the fibers and the IP, then you've got a lot of it. But if you're in Zambia, which is a landlocked country in the middle of Africa, it took 5 to 10 years for the trenches to be dug and the fibers to be pulled right into Zambia. Now, many telcos have done a really good job in fibering up and making rings and all resilient internet connectivity. But the price of data is still very significant. So you've got there's not a lot of internet compared to Europe in terms of like total gigabits or whatever throughput per second, particular throughput in the middle of Africa. You've also got, on average, a lower income per capita, which means that if you buy data bundles, it's more significant to you if you are in Zambia than it is if you're in the UK. In fact, we could even get unlimited data on our SIMs for tens of pounds. I've not come across I know many, if any, sub-Saharan African countries where you can have unlimited internet. You might be able to have unlimited WhatsApps or unlimited social. But not unlimited streaming. And so if you were to download a podcast, it's not going to take a gig, is it? It's going to be a gigabyte. It's going to be hundreds of megabytes, if that. And that's not going to cost you very much. But if you're going to listen to live streaming, you'd be burning your income with very little benefit. So I kind of see there's a hybrid, which is live radio is good if you're bouncing around on the back of a minibus and you just want some music and stuff going on in the background. You're in a shop and the shop wants to have a bit of an ambiance. If you are pottering around the house or driving around in your car and you want to feel connected with what's going on, you've got your radio, you've got your call-in programs and your personalities that you know, and they're your friends. And so there is a role for radio in those environments. But you, in taxis, you might find them listening to an MP3, a CD of 100 MP3s or maybe a USB thumb drive or whatever, which means that the on-demand content, which we see growing phenomenally as podcasts in the UK and Europe, well, and beyond, I think podcasts are going to be a really viable and serious way of broadcasting, to misuse the term broadcasting, perhaps, in places like Africa. If you're sitting in the back of a minibus with your headphones in, it's less likely you'll be streaming Spotify, and more likely you'll have loaded your phone up when you were at a Wi-Fi in town, and maybe that's a podcast or something else you're listening to. There's a kind of a hybrid approach. That's that's where I'd see it. So if I were to start a radio station now, I would live stream, because there's a diaspora. There are people that want to tune in to a radio station from their home city around the world, and the costs of doing it are not very great. But I'd do on-demand content, and it wouldn't be the on-demand content of The Breakfast Show or similar. It would be more meaty, more talky, I think, a variety of podcasts.
You said that the first station you set up continues to this day.
Yep.
As does the second one. Do they both live stream as well?
Yes, because they're being based in cities these days. You've got fiber, you've got access to DSL, you've got your outgoing internet circuit is fine, and it finds its way over to servers in Miami or wherever your hosting provider is, and they'll pay, you know, $100 a month for the circuit, the tail circuit, and $20-$30 a month, maybe a bit more for the, you know, the restreaming of it. So why not?
Yeah, it's not a big cost on top of everything else.
No, it's not. It's not. I think you may as well do it.
I can see why you enjoyed that challenge, and it kind of cemented your heart down in Zambia and Africa as a whole.
I go back when I can as well. And, you know, as well as the sheer technical and operational joy of it, I've got friends in the middle of Africa that when we see each other again, it's, you know, it's a great time of celebration, because we pioneered together, we loved working together, went through a few odd hard times together, but, you know, it's a little bit different from going into an office in London, which I've done for part of my career as well. I'd hug some of my old colleagues, but I think in Zambia it was a slightly raw experience which left us more bonded.
Thank you very much for sharing those photos. That helps people connect with the story. I think what's important is understanding the importance of radio in every country. And we've seen more recent examples of that. And at Radio Tech Con, the last 2 years, we've heard direct stories from people in areas of conflict talking about how they are keeping the radio working and TV in certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. Difficulties there, and it just reminds us the importance, you know, getting these things right. And as you say, doing it whether you're in opulence with lots of money or isolated in the bush, one way or another, it needs to keep going. And I think that the need for that connection to the country and to keep people company is almost as important as the role it plays when times aren't so good, about these moments when broadcasting changes within a country. And I'm glad that you were part of that and could share that. So thanks a lot for coming on the show and talking about that. The best way for everybody to say thank you to Phil is to click like and subscribe if you're not already, because we've hit 100 on this channel and there'll be another 100 soon to come. So thanks again, Phil. Look forward to speaking to you again in the future.
Thank you and take care.